We bring you back now to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario for the 2015 Homelessness Marathon. It's 5:30 in the morning Eastern Time, and we move to our second last segment of this 15-hour broadcast from CKMS in Waterloo, Ontario. As Dan, the host, mentions, the marathon is in its 17th year. When you consider that it started in the United States, we are in our 13th year here in Canada. Good morning to those of you who are just waking up and tuning in. And we've got an hour and a half left of Homelessness Marathon this year to go.
You are listening to CKMS Radio 100.3 FM in Waterloo, Ontario, soundfm.ca on the web, and this is the 2015 Homelessness Marathon hosted by CFRC in Kingston. This is the 17th annual marathon and the fourth time CKMS has participated. My name is Dan Keller, Lieutenant of News at CKMS, and tonight we have put together a small roundtable discussion with members of Alliance Against Poverty, a grassroots anti-poverty group based in Waterloo Region.
Check AllianceAgainstPoverty.com for more on their work.
I'm Braden McNeil. I'm a student at the University of Waterloo, and I've been a member of the AAP for almost 2 years, I think.
Oz Kolarnell, I'm a retired professor, retired Lutheran minister. I've been in the Alliance Against Poverty from its origins in 2008.
Martin Suter, I've also been in AAP since its founding in 2008. I'm one of the members of the group who lived the life. I'm on ODSP, so I've got an income of a bit less than $1,000 a month.
So the AAP stands for Alliance Against Poverty, and mostly it's an anti-poverty kind of advocacy group. We touch base with the region of Waterloo a lot and other community organizations and just try to shed a light on poverty issues in the region.
What's the focus of the AAP? Like, what kind of campaigns are you working on right now?
Basically, I think it's twofold. Internally, we have a token exchange of wealth. Those of us who are middle income give $50 a month. Those who live the life take $50 a month. It's a token, but those that live the life need that and need a whole lot more. Those of us who give it miss it, but not a whole lot. But that token is very important. As far as campaigns, we're an activist group and an advocacy group chiefly, and I'll let the others elaborate on that as they so choose.
Well, I think the great thing about how we have different types of members, some of whom donate $50 a month, others who receive $50 a month, I think it's pretty nifty just because it's a way of us to actually practice the values and, you know, the wealth redistribution that we espouse, you know, that we constantly tell other people to.
And we've learned, too, there's a third group, those that can't afford, but those that aren't quite living the life, and they're on the edge. Mm. We have those as well.
Something that I think is really important about this thing where people in a group who can afford to upload $50 each month, and then people living on the edge receive $50, is that it's absolutely not a charity thing.
Right on.
That it's simply a matter of social justice.
So it's a bit of a mutual aid type model here?
It's a model. It's a token in the sense that it doesn't equalize. But like Marty said, it's justice. This isn't a gift. This is not charity. It's just the society should operate on the same basis of wealth distribution.
And beyond that, what kind of campaigns are you working on actively?
Three main campaigns. The first one is sort of, we have a living wage subcommittee, and so there's three or four people on that committee, and we've been working with Living Wage Waterloo Region, which is, it's a pretty new organization in the region. Back in, I think, November, they launched their employer recognition program, and basically what that organization does is they, together with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives Ontario, they've calculated a living wage for the region, which is based on actual regional costs of living, such as rent. It factors in public transit, factors in the cost of food, and you know, things like child care subsidies. You know, these are things that are regionally specific. So they calculated our living wage at $16 an hour. And so one of our big campaigns has just been to help them. So right now, we've been going to employers. We've been trying to find ones that pay their employees $16 an hour so that we can get them on board with Living Wage Waterloo Region so that they can build up some momentum and eventually start, you know, targeting the bigger fish, the companies that, you know, Tim Hortons and McDonald's or the region itself, which has a lot of contractors which aren't paid a living wage. And so that subcommittee is also involved in a few, well, not actively involved right now in minimum wage campaigns, but this year there's going to be a big provincial campaign and national campaign as well for to go for a $15 federally mandated minimum wage.
And also we're involved in transit issues. I'll just mention the one. There's a food hamper on Guelph Street where people can pick up food hampers run by the House of Friendship. They canceled, the region canceled the bus to that. We said, now wait a minute, if you do that, you can take the one bus route, number 6, segue it around easily. The only extra cost would be to move a sign, a bus sign, and they would have nothing to do with it. So we tried to use the humiliation approach. We showed that carrying a basket would weigh just too much up that hill. So far it hasn't done any good, but we haven't given up that battle yet.
No, in fact, I think in a few weeks we have some things planned about that. So this has been ongoing since last summer.
Leading into this winter, many of the out of the cold overnight shelters stopped offering services. Mm-hmm. What has been happening at the grassroots level and at the governmental level, at the regional level, to combat these closures and try to fight the homelessness?
I can speak to that. First of all, the record chastised the churches from cutting back, which I think was a wrong thing to do, because basically the churches have been a stopgap measure from the get-go, where the government would say, well, go to the church, go out of the cold. Then they stopped. All of a sudden it became a big campaign issue. There was a lot of noise made about it. The YWCA was pressured, and good for them, to provide emergency housing. But emergency housing isn't enough. It just isn't enough. It's stopgap. And basically, our housing subcommittee is in line with people like Catherine Savage at First United and others that want more social housing and not just stopgap measures to jam people in to save their lives and then pat ourselves on the back. And that's what's been happening.
Yeah, I think the region's response basically was to have the YWCA, I think it's 50 beds, that they added to the, you know, to their, I don't know, like their stock of emergency shelter. But the problem with that, first of all, is that it doesn't, like on multiple nights in the week, used to be Out of the Cold would have multiple churches. So the numbers just don't add up. On some nights, you know, the Out of the Cold program would have maybe 100 beds available. Right. Now it's down to like an additional 50 on any given day. But the real problem with just the fact that the region is responding with a YWCA, you know, beds, is that there's a lot of people, homeless people, who don't want to, you know, they don't want to go to the region's shelter programs because, you know, the region is, they have like no alcohol policies and all these other policies that make it difficult for people who live on the streets to basically take advantage of the sheltering program. So out of the cold program, sometimes they would turn a blind eye to that, and so it was the preferred option.
Not just difficult, but for people who are actually addicted to drugs or alcohol, it's not just difficult, it's impossible.
Yeah.
And it's again blaming the victim. It's again that approach. And also, I remember a piece by Louisa D'Amato praising our region for how well they do the homelessness thing. I think that's appalling. The very fact that there are these desperate measures taken is itself an indictment of misplaced priorities in the region. Housing should be a top-notch priority, social housing.
Housing is a right. It should be
yes.
A right. It is a right, and it should be recognized as a right.
More than that, by dollars and cents, and by brick and mortar. You can get all the talk you want, but unless you get the brick and mortar there, people suffer.
Well, with these closures of the Out of the Cold program, the regional government seemed to have been announcing that they were starting to build more. They were gonna start building more social housing units or start paying for them. Is that true? Have they been added, or what's happened at the government level since then?
So here's the affordable housing story in our region since 2001, I think. In 2001, the region had a goal to add 500 affordable housing units in the next 4 years, and they did that in 4 years. Then they decided to add an additional 500, an additional 500, and an additional 500. So by the time 2013 or 14 rolled around, there was about 2,000 units or so. Now the region's cutting the budget for affordable housing. So I believe that they're cutting the budget by about 2%. And what they want to do with the money, basically the region hasn't set aside any money for affordable housing. They rely entirely on provincial and federal funding, which is fine, I guess. The problem is that there is no provincial or federal plan for affordable housing. So it's a fly by the seat of your pants type situation. Like, will there be money 1 year? Will there not be money? Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Not only that, the very fact that the region isn't applying any dollars then gives them no leverage or muscle to pressure the province and the feds. The very fact that there is money regionally, anybody that makes it, I remember when I ran for regional chair, what I said was, other than giving my $158,000 to poverty issues, you had a bundle of people making over $100,000 a year, you could flatline their pay and turn that pay over to public housing. There's no real proof that they give a damn about public housing.
And the other thing is that the waiting list to get on, you know, into affordable housing in the region of Waterloo has just been growing and growing and growing. Mm-hmm. Even since, you know, 2001, when I would say, you know, the 500 units in a 4 year period, that seems like a decent goal. It still didn't cover the need because the waiting list has continued to grow for over a decade. Now, so, you know, 500 units over 4 years, about 125 units a year, new units. Now the region has just released their affordable housing strategy, well, not just, like last year or something, and they're planning to basically retain 350 of the units that would otherwise, you know, be taken out of the program because they need renovations or something like that, and they're going to add an additional 350 units to 2019. So that's about 75 units per year. It's about half of what they were doing before. And the waiting list has never been bigger. So the problem is that, you know, we've got this housing issue, which is not being addressed. And now they're just dropping the ball further. They're cutting the funding. They're, you know.
Now, you mentioned the massive waiting list to get a social housing waiting list. Are there barriers to get on that waiting list? And once you get, say, once you get a social housing unit, are there barriers to keeping that and staying in your house?
The biggest barrier is living long enough to make it.
The biggest barrier is there's not enough social housing. And then, Marty, your own experience in terms of any gain, the whole public-private stuff. Why don't you explain a bit about that? Because it's beyond the issue simply of homelessness. If you just focus on that, that's the immediate crisis, no doubt. You just focus on that. When spring and summer come along, you can forget it. But the issue's deeper than that. Marty knows that from just simply housing for poor people.
Yeah, what happens is, first of all, the shelter allowance on social assistance is absolutely obscene. For ODSP, I think the shelter allowance is $445 a month. For OW, it's even less. I think it's about $400 a month. So what happens with, first of all, nobody on that income, unless you're subsidized, can have any sort of decent accommodation. All you can get is usually just a room in a flop house. And the problem is that the landlords of these places, since they're serving the very bottom end of the rental market, their clientele has nowhere else to go, so they set their rents at what social services pays for a shelter allowance. So if the shelter allowance, not that this is even going to happen, but just for example, if they just said, okay, next year we're going to increase the shelter allowance by 10%, all that would happen First of all, 10% wouldn't get anybody out of a room house into an apartment. But secondly, all that would happen is the landlords would all increase their rent by exactly 10%. So, just, I've been on ODSP since 1997 or 1998, and just an example of how things have changed. In 1998, I was paying normal market rent. I had a small basement apartment in a house. It wasn't much of an apartment, but I think my rent back then was $280 or $290 a month. And I was on ODSP, and I was paying that. I wasn't subsidized. I didn't need to be subsidized. Now, a small one-bedroom apartment in Kitchener goes for about $750 a month, but the shelter allowance is only at $440 a month, and that is the price of a room in a rooming house now. Since 1998 till now, like, I used to be able to pay normal market rent. Now I'm. My shelter allowance is only about half of what normal market rent would be.
And you know what you're saying, in effect, it's a private-public partnership. You're the private person, the person who lives a life of private, the public provides other money, and it all goes into the pockets of slum landlords.
Into private hands.
Yeah, and that's part of the issue, is the structure itself is against vulnerable people.
Mm.
I looked up the qualifications, right, for getting on the affordable housing list. There doesn't seem to be anything that's too, you know, restrictive. Like, there's things where you can't owe money on rent to different federal, provincial, or municipally funded housing providers. That's probably, you know, the people who need to get on the list are the people who are going to owe money to on rent and damages. You know, but there's nothing that doesn't seem anything too crazy. The problem is that the waiting list is years long.
Right.
That's the real problem.
It's over 5 years now.
Yeah. It's getting worse, not better. For all the self-congratulatory behavior. See, if you can focus on homelessness, and unfortunately for the politicians, they were stymied because all of a sudden the out of the cold shut down. How can we explain this? We'll provide quick emergency. Aren't we wonderful? There's a bishop in Brazil. He's dead now, but I'm going to paraphrase something he said. When I'm concerned about the homeless, they call me a saint. When I ask why there's a homelessness problem, they call me a communist. So we need to get at the structural basis of that, and it ultimately is about wealth distribution. There's a place, Dauphin, Manitoba, years ago provided annual income, a guaranteed annual income that was adequate, what we'd call a living wage, and it worked. People learned, they worked together, they saved when they could, they enjoyed life a little bit, then they cancel out, and they'll give a little bit here, a little bit there. Now they'll throw a nickel or two at poor people and expect them to survive. And this is what's wrong.
And you are listening to the 2015 Homelessness Marathon on CKMS 100.3 FM in Waterloo, soundfm.ca on the web. We are speaking with Martin, Oz, and Braden from Alliance Against Poverty. Let's get back to the discussion.
It was brought up that one of the problems of the shelter, emergency shelter services, a lot of them are they don't allow drugs or alcohol or
well, not just that they don't allow. I mean, that kind of implies that they don't allow a person to use those things inside the shelter, which that would make. I mean, that's perfectly understandable. What they don't allow is for someone to come who's already under the influence of these things, who have used them outside, and so it's not a matter of they don't allow them to use drugs or alcohol in the shelter. That wouldn't be an issue for most people, I'm sure. But if someone shows up, if they're addicted to alcohol, they show up. They've had some drinks, and they're quote intoxicated. They wouldn't be allowed in.
What happens at that point?
To be honest with you, I don't know.
They could well be left on their own and could well die.
Before they could go to the out of the cold, but now they are out of luck.
Right. While we were chatting beforehand, you had mentioned someone was talking about deaths in the region.
Well, this is at the regional council today. Brigitte stood up and used her 10 minutes to name the people who had died at the end of 2014 and into 2015.
And the conditions that they died in.
Yes. And these were all people on poverty, basically people that lived the life. Hmm. And this was read with dignity.
Some of those obituaries here.
So there's a...
It's a blog on, you know, Jane Mitchell. She's a regional counselor. I believe it's her blog, right?
Could be. I don't remember.
Well, somebody, I think it's Jane Mitchell's blog. They've been publishing these obituaries for poor people who die in the region pretty regularly, I guess, for a few months now. And, yeah, so today, Brigitte was at regional council reading them. Hmm. Pretty moving stuff.
Very powerful.
And every one of these people who died, some of the people were actually homeless people and they died on the street from exposure, but the majority of the people on her list, I think she read off about 10 or 12 names.
Yes. And told about them personally.
Yeah. And what they died of was actually complications of the disease of poverty.
That's right.
One thing, and this touched me very personally because I'm very close to the situation myself. Several of the people that she mentioned who had died recently were diabetic. And I'm diabetic. It's mostly under control now, but when I don't have money, I eat at the soup kitchen or the food bank. I get food. The problem is that these places get, I don't blame them because they get whatever food is donated to them, but what they get is not healthy food. For the last couple of weeks, I've been going to the soup kitchen just about every day. Some days I can't eat what they serve because it's just really unhealthy. But basically, today, yesterday, and 3 days last week, the main course was pasta. Pasta's okay to eat once in a while, but not to eat every day. And they had meat. Today they had chunks of fried bologna, and they weren't giving you like slices of it. They were giving you chunks about an inch thick by about 2.5 inches in diameter, cut off a big chunk of bologna, and they were people's plates. They were piling them like 3, 4. Some people were getting 5 of these things. This is what people are eating every day. Well, if you're not diabetic, you very soon will be. The bologna is fat and salt. Salt causes heart, it causes heart disease and high blood pressure. A steady diet of starch causes diabetes. And then, I mean, that's what most of the people that Brigitte mentioned, they either died from their diabetes or they had heart attacks or strokes. Well, that is directly diet-related.
Again, a particular theologian from Latin America read.
And all these people lived alone.
Yeah.
Because when you're living in poverty, they didn't have close family. They
isolation.
Lived alone. They didn't have they didn't have a partner or lover with them. They were, and that's... these are all complications of poverty, but when you bring them all together, people die.
Yeah. Hmm. And I think as this one guy mentioned that I'm reading, it whacked me right between the eyes. He said, watch the rhetoric we use, be careful. And he said, it's murder. He said, when the society can do something about poverty and doesn't, and people die, they're murdered. And I think that's a good, strong word that applies to it. These people are murdered.
Yeah, these weren't accidental deaths because they were completely preventable.
Yeah, they were discards. Mm. People that live on the streets, people that live under poverty, are discards of the society. They don't consume enough.
Yeah. In fact, we're eyesores to those who do.
Yeah, yes, yes.
You could use stronger language than that, too. There's a book called, it's Capitalism, a Structural Genocide.
Yes, that's so, that's right. That's right.
You can use really strong words if you.
And then we need to use those words. We need to use those words because that's so. It isn't just something, an injustice that we're working on. I think of my own church, and I love my own church. We have boxes and bags for food, and I've checked these out. Most of them are starch in boxed food. We do this. We know there's poverty. Therefore, we do this, and we walk away. And that is a horrible, horrible, that's an example of capitalist genocide.
I always tell people, like I know some middle-income people who occasionally buy food at the supermarket and donate it to the food bank. And whenever they talk to me about this, I tell them, you know what, don't go and buy peanut butter or Kraft dinner, or cans of beans. So the soup or the food bank already has tons of that stuff. I said, just for the hell of it, spend money, buy something really nice, some luxury food. Instead of a can of tuna, buy a can of crab meat. When you're in poverty and you're getting food from soup kitchens and food banks, you get all kinds of peanut butter and pasta and beans, but just once in a while to have something nice, something that other people get to eat sometimes.
Right. This is the one, for all our failings in the Alliance Against Poverty, one thing is clear, and when we, like myself, of middle income, work with people who live the life, we're confronted with it. Mm. It isn't this, I'm going to one night shut down my lights for the sake of the environment. This isn't one week I'm going to live the life of poverty to identify with. I'm not going to sleep out overnight or for a whole week to show how I identify. That's insulting. Mm. What we need to do is change this situation. And I think we as middle-income people have ways to protect ourselves and our sense of conscience. And that's a dodge, a serious dodge, I think. Mm.
This is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it's not really tongue-in-cheek. But I was thinking about, like people who do symbolic things, like on Buy Nothing Day, they buy nothing. Or people who will sleep out for one night. Well, that's kind of meaningless. I think what they should do, on Buy Nothing Day, don't buy anything, but take the money that you save from buying nothing and give it to someone who almost every day is a buy nothing day.
I agree with that.
And for sleeping, instead of sleeping out on the street one night, in a symbolic gesture, instead of doing that, take somebody who's on the street and bring them into your home for a night.
I agree with everything but one thing. It isn't meaningless because it's used as a dodge. It serves our own salving of conscience. And in that sense, it's heinous.
True.
Yeah.
Well, guys, that's looks like that about wraps up our time here. Anything you want to close with real quick before we go out? How can people find out about Alliance Against Poverty? More info?
Go to allianceagainstpoverty.com. Yeah.
Run it one word, all lowercase, AllianceAgainstPoverty.com, and you'll find out about us.
Great, and we'll link to that through the soundfm.ca webpage.
And that was Martin, Oz, and Braden from KW-based Alliance Against Poverty.
Check AllianceAgainstPoverty.com for more on their work.
This has been the CKMS contribution to the 2015 Homelessness Radio Marathon. Stay tuned in as we move back to this year's hosts at CFRC in Kingston. Thanks for listening.
From Incarcerated Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and you're listening to Waves Through Walls, Prison Radio, on CKMS, 100.3, soundfm.ca, in Waterloo.